Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations with the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 139 of Wheat All About It, or what I've entitled Direct Seeding, a System of Change. About my conversation with Ty Meyer, Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest Direct Seed Association and Production Ag Manager for the Spokane Conservation District. I've always had a soft spot for the Pacific Northwest Direct Seed Association, abbreviated PNDSA, and the longer I have remained in agriculture, the more I have come to appreciate the philosophy behind the practices they preach. But it hasn't been easy. There have been technological and agronomic challenges, as well as political and philosophical differences that you'll hear about ahead. Meyer's wife, Kay, served as part-time director of the PNDSA for several years before leaving for a full-time job. It made sense that Ty would take on the organization's part-time responsibilities in addition to his current job. The Spokane Conservation District has been a leader in helping transition conventional wheat farmers in the county into direct seeders through various cost-share and rental programs. Exactly how much wheat acreage is in direct seed is open to question. In episode 129, when I interviewed Chris Mertz of the National Agricultural Statistics Service about the 2017 Census of Agriculture, he estimated that 805,000 grain acres in Washington fell under the no-till practice. For the record, about 2.2 million acres of wheat is harvested annually in eastern Washington. If the figures are correct, that means direct seed acres in the state stand at about 36% of the total, although some individual counties have a much higher adoption rate. There are times doing this podcast when I don't realize how good an interview was until after I start production and listen to it again a few times. I'm also surprised from time to time by the nature of my questions. I throw Meyer very few softballs, and I have to admit, I was even surprised as I listened how tough they were. But then that's what makes this podcast memorable. Meyer wasn't put off by my fastballs. He took each question in stride and hit most of them out of the park. Take this interaction. Back in my reporting days, there was a real dichotomy between direct seeders and conventional farmers. PNDSA members were convinced, and they were very outspoken about it at the time, that direct seeding was the best approach to farming. Is that still the modus operandi of the organization?
Well, I find this discussion probably one of the most interesting right now. As long as I can remember, the vast majority of the direct seeders that we work with have a belief that what they're doing is a better way of protecting their land and mitigating environmental impacts. The point of contention has always been that direct seeders have long been dismissed as some type of radical group or farmers that are preaching in some way, you know, to people in certain areas. And the reality that I see is that these farmers are doing what's right for their land, what they feel is right for the environment, their families, and right now we see it from the public. There's a lot the public has to say about what we're doing. You know, and so when we have that type of discussion, I start to look at why is there that feeling that direct seeders are in some way a group of people that have a different message, you know, and I look at it and I say, well, I think there's an assumption that that resistance comes from an unwillingness to potentially admit that what we've been doing for the last century might have been wrong, the way that we grow our crops, going away from the way nature kind of had things planned for us, and heavy tillage really led to a lot of our monoculture type systems. And so, I think the direct seed community at large has adopted a system of change. Before anything else, they've embraced the fact that there may be a better way of growing our food and have less impact on our environment. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that message is something that needs to be heard. And I'm still kind of amazed when I travel around and I hear some of that level of resistance. There's even some disdain out there for direct seeders in this region and no-tillers. And you know, how do you explain it? I don't know how you explain it. I think it's explained better by, you know, the reality that change is hard for some people. That, you know, I look at technology. Technology today, you know, in our world has changed and advanced to levels that were unheard of even 20 years ago. And so should our farming practices. You know, I think things have to continue to evolve. And so to me, it's a bold statement to assume that heavy tillage systems that have been around for the last century or longer should continue to be the way that the best way to farm our land. And so, I'm going to finish that, I guess, statement with a question, and that is there another industry in our country today that uses the same technology to operate today as they did in the 1800s?
No. What's been the most important element in allowing the direct seed transition to occur? Is it horsepower, hydraulics, glyphosate, or something else? Mm-hmm.
So a number of things, I guess, to address that question. I don't think personally horsepower, I think it's irrelevant at this day and age. Agriculture, industrial ag has led us down the road of big equipment, whether you're using tillage or direct seed or no-till. So the switch to a direct seed or no-till drill for many producers doesn't require horsepowering the farm. The equipment's there. If it's not, you can size your, you can find the drill that your equipment can handle. For the most part, hydraulics can be an issue on some of the older tractors and things that are out there, maybe not having the capacity to handle some of the big fan systems and things that are required. But generally, I would say the horsepower is out there and it's available for people. So I don't see that as a major hurdle myself in the adoption. I think this is somewhere where we need to be clear about glyphosate as well. Direct seeders use it in lieu of tillage in many operations, but we have to understand that glyphosate is used across all operations. It's being used as a tool in tillage systems too, prior to tillage to manage weeds, and so where the direct seeders are using it, it's an important tool for them. I don't think, though, personally, that glyphosate is probably the major tool or component of allowing people to transition. I do think it's still one of the tools in the system that they need as they progress. The real reason I think we're seeing the adoption of direct seed and no-till increase is that we have farmers that have a need to become more efficient and more protective of their natural resources on the ground. They're understanding that their soil resources are important, and that the continuous tillage we've done for decades has virtually eroded the ability of our soil to provide our crops with the nutrients they need. So, you know, we're at a time where in some of our soils, we have to add every nutrient that's needed for a crop to grow. It's simply a medium to put a seed in, and that has an impact. And so the ability of the producer to change and to understand there may be a different way, I think, is really leading the charge right now. That's at the forefront in people's mind right now.
Direct seed started in the higher moisture areas of eastern Washington and, of course, the Pacific Northwest as a whole, and expanded into the drier areas, and then the drier areas pulled back after several dry years. Where is the practice now with regard to what we think of as the summer fallow areas of the state?
Yeah, I believe that we've seen some of the biggest growth for direct seed adoption in the dry regions of the Pacific Northwest. The ground cover components of the system have an amazing impact on soil temperature, wind impacts, and moisture retention for those producers. And you really only have to look at what is occurring in the dry regions around Mansfield, Ritzville, and the Horse Heavens to see that direct seed isn't just working, but it's thriving. Those operations are finding ways of using the system to implement highly diversified crops to take advantage of the moisture they have when they have it. So the adoption rates in some of those regions are extraordinary right now, the amount of people that are actually moving into direct seed and no-till systems.
Certainly 20 years ago, people would have said you could never make direct seed work in those dry areas. What's changed?
I think technology has changed tremendously. I think our drills and the equipment that's being used has the capacity to manage heavier residues and things But I think more importantly, we're finding out the benefit of retaining residue, that there's a moisture retention component to it, that those dry regions have an opportunity to, with their fallow systems, to change things right now and utilize moisture more. When our fallow systems are only so efficient in gathering moisture in an idle year, some of these producers are finding out that they can put other crops in and really diversify the rotations. So they've got, in essence, may have more opportunity in some of those areas than our annual cropping regions.
Interesting. Back when I was a reporter for the Capital Press, I went to the Dakota Lakes Research Facility. I heard Dwayne Beck speak, and it was rotation, rotation, rotation. And now, I mean, you see a lot of farmers out here just planting wheat after wheat after wheat and doing it successfully. Is rotation really needed in a direct seed system anymore?
Yeah, I think rotation is still a pretty major aspect of what we're doing. You know, we talked earlier about different weed control issues and things, and so we're starting to see that across all of agriculture, using different modes of action on different weeds and things. I think rotation provides a huge benefit that way. Where we're starting to see, again, a lot of these guys looking at much more diverse crop rotations, it's for a soil health benefit. They know that they need to diversify the rotation to start changing their soil composition. And so, you know, our equipment enables us to do a lot of things these days. And so, you know, you've got producers that have figured out a system that they can utilize different crops more than one time in a row. And then you've got other regions that simply can't get away with wheat on wheat on wheat. They've got to diversify. We've got disease issues in our wetter regions that are going to have an impact over time on yield. And so I think that's a question that has to be answered by each region, you know, what they can manage in their system.
What do you think about the folks that are taking straw off of their fields to feed the pulp plant down by Starbucks? Is there a philosophy that you shouldn't be taking the straw off your fields? Or, you know, in some of these high residue areas, you got so much, it's hard to get through. What's the opinion of the PNDSA?
I think there's multiple different answers to that question. Some of the direct seed systems that are used out there today are challenged to manage some of the very heavy residues, as you said. So there's a lot of straw removal that goes on some of those systems just so they can then come back in and direct seed directly into the residue that's left without having to do another pass on the field, whether it's a shredder or some other means of managing that residue. They're able to just take it off and it's gone. It's not a concern of theirs. We do have a group of direct seed and no-till guys that are very concerned about the amount of nutrients leaving the farm when it's baled off and removed. There's been a lot of research done that quantifies the value of that in terms of nutrient value in dollars over time. So I think you've got, you know, there's a lot of things, there are a lot of different answers to that question, and there's reasons people are doing it. It is another revenue source. I understand that for some of these operations. But one of the things we're finding, especially in some of our drier regions, is our challenge is just to grow enough residue to put it on the fields, to protect the fields from temperature and moisture loss. So I think we just need to be clear. Residue can be a valuable part and is a valuable part of these operations.
But there's no opposition to taking straw off of direct seed fields.
We haven't established a policy that would, as an association, that would indicate one way or the other on that. I think it's, again, about how a producer effectively manages their direct seed and no-till system and provide, you know, find some success in how they can get through their residues in those fields.
I know cover crops are being used pretty extensively in the Midwest, less so out here, and I have certainly talked to folks who have told me that they just will never work in our system where we have this winter precipitation. What do you think about cover crops? Will we ever have a system of cover crops in the PNW?
I think most definitely we will. I think it's just a matter of time. We have to figure out what crops we're going to utilize and how we're going to fit them into our systems. Some of the you know, personally, I believe that some of the best opportunity for cover crops might be in our drier regions because they have a fallow year in their system versus our annual cropping region. It's tough to figure out where to fit a cover crop in. How do we, you mentioned moisture as our major issue, and it is. In the Midwest, in some of the high rainfall regions where they can interseed a cover crop into a corn crop, a standing corn crop, and get enough rain that when the corn comes off, they have a standing cover crop under it. We don't have that scenario. So we're trying to figure out how we integrate cover crops into some of our systems. And, you know, I think it's going to happen. It was done prior to the big industrial ag movement that occurred 50, 60 years ago. I mean, it was all plow down clovers and things in this region, and it was integrated. It was one of their crops. That was their nitrogen crop. We've got a pretty good group of producers that are stepping back right now looking at maybe there needs to be an additional year in our crop rotation for a cover crop.
Maybe, but the reason that we have fallow is to accumulate moisture, and a cover crop is going to suck that moisture out of the ground.
Well, that's, I think there's a lot to be learned on that. We've got some guys in some of our dry regions that have put cover crops in that actually have figured out they have more moisture in the cover crop ground than they do in the fallow where they have no crop on it. And that's because they're creating a microenvironment with that cover crop on that ground. And so they're seeing some changes. It's evolving. I don't know the answer to it, but certainly we've got some pretty interesting things happen around the region right now. Personally, down on the Palouse, even this year, we've got cover crop trials on a variety of farms. Where we have good cover crops in the fields, some of the radishes and turnips right now that are growing, you can actually see in any bare ground between the cover crop plants, it's dry down several inches. If you pull the leaves back on the radishes and turnips, there's moisture to the top of the ground. Where you would think that plant would be utilizing all the moisture there, it's actually creating an area where there's moisture right to the surface. So we don't understand it necessarily, but we're seeing some of the impacts to some of these crops out here right now.
I get the impression that there are two segments of direct seeders, like dark beer and light beer, and that the dark beer direct seeders have embraced the practice as a philosophy, which goes far beyond the sort of drill that's used, and the light beer direct seeders have purchased a direct seed drill, but they're less interested in the philosophy. Am I off base here?
Well, I think there's a reason that I make a distinction between direct seed and no-till. They're two different systems, but both have tremendous environmental and economic benefit. We have producers that are just beginning to direct seed, and the Direct Seed Association has embraced them as an important part of their mission to try to help educate them and reduce the learning curve for them. And then we have this group of highly advanced direct seeders, whether they're direct seed or no-till. There is a distinction there, but they're moving well beyond the equipment aspects of the system. It's no longer an issue of equipment. They've moved beyond that and are looking for something else. So, you know, they're really concerned about soil and that next level of profitability on the farm. And so is there a dichotomy between the two? I don't think there is. I think that you've got people that are just in different phases of adoption that really help, you know, have to have different challenges addressed as they progress through that system.
Okay. All right. I've done several podcasts which have addressed glyphosate, also known as Roundup, including the problems that are besetting the chemical in terms of lawsuits against it, and then there is weed resistance to it. Now, Bayer has lost three cases that have gone to trial, you know, millions of dollars, and there are 13,000 suits that are waiting in the wings. Meanwhile, weeds like downy brome and Russian thistle, as well as others, have been found to be resistant to glyphosate. Now, weed scientists say that's just the tip of the iceberg. Can direct seeders farm in a direct seed fashion without an effective broad-spectrum herbicide like Roundup?
Well, let's face it. Without Roundup, many farming systems are going to have a challenge. Direct seeders will need additional help to find other ways of managing weed resistance. Paraquat could be used, I think, in their systems, but it's not a tool that many of them want to use, and quite often for safety reasons. But to say across the board that tillage is going to be required is kind of taking the easy way out on this. Tillage is, has always been a method of conventional farming systems to alleviate the weed concerns. I think we need to think about it a little bit harder before we make a wholesale recommendation to go to tillage. One of the questions I always have is, why have the weeds persisted in our region for decades to the point that they're now resistant to our chemical controls? And when I step back and look at that, I look at the last 30 or 40 years, and we see tillage being done across the region to combat weeds and to make an acceptable seed bed that our equipment can handle. And the reality is the weeds continue to come back, and more tillage is required each year to keep those same weeds at bay. So are we really controlling the weeds at all with our tillage systems?
Are you saying then that you do not believe that tillage is necessary in a direct seed system ever?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that a wholesale message that tillage is going to be needed to manage our resistance issues is something that I think we need to take really good care in saying right now. We've got direct seed and no-till guys that are looking beyond tillage as a tool. They're keeping it in their toolbox if they need it, no doubt. But we need help in really looking at what other controls we can use on those systems. And it's really about diversifying crop rotations, looking at some of these cover crop methods of suppressing weeds on these farms, really looking at our soil health. Weeds are an indicator of a deficiency in soil condition in some way, shape, or form, typically. So do we have a deficiency in our soil that we can manage that would help take care of weeds before they end up in our fields? And so those are the things where we really hope that we can see or get help down the road instead of just, going out and saying tillage is going to become a component of our direct seed systems. It's a tool. There's no doubt. We're not idealistic enough to say that you have to, you have to remove that from the toolbox. Everything's a tool out there right now to help manage these systems. Many of these guys are quite a few years into their direct seed and no-till systems, and they're concerned about soil and soil structure. And so we know the damage that heavy tillage can do, even in a single pass, to the system. And so you have great concern from some of the producers if that was a tool they had to go out and use.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, you've been making a distinction between no-till and direct seed. Now, back when I was a reporter, I learned that no-till basically left a bad taste in farmers' mouths because they tried it in the 70s. They didn't have the technology to make it successful. And that when the second iteration of no-till came around, they said, well, that's changed the name to direct seed. Mm-hmm. Now, is that true or not?
Back in the 70s and early 80s, you had a challenge with no-till. Things were occurring. We had equipment that came in that enabled farmers to do things they hadn't been able to do in the past. They could seed monoculture crops on top of wheat on wheat on wheat because they had the capacity to do it. And there were some challenges with it. We didn't understand disease. We were fortunate to have Jim Cook figure out the Greenbridge issue in wheat, which really created a system where we could manage disease and move forward with direct seed and no-till systems. But that name change occurred, I think, because back in that time you had a challenge with no-till. People put the challenges on the back of no-till versus the lack of understanding on disease issues and carryover as we moved forward. So you saw the name, I think, direct seed come out. Today, I make the distinction between direct seed and no-till because, in my opinion, they're two different things. Direct seed is it's the level where people are using potentially higher disturbance direct seed drills. They're in single or two-pass type systems that are very very well-rounded in terms of conservation. They manage high amounts of residue. They leave it on the ground, so they're very effective and efficient and profitable for those people to do that. And then we have a group of people that have progressed beyond direct seed into no-till. And that's the distinction, where that distinction comes from on my part, is we have no-tillers in the region now, and they're not afraid to say they're no-tillers because there's very little tillage, if any, being done on those operations. And they progress to a high level. They're managing heavy amounts of residue on their operations, and a lot of them are pretty profitable doing it. So they deserve to have that distinction made between the two types of conservation systems. The progression that we generally see that we've seen to this point are the people that get into direct seed potentially start with higher disturbance direct seed drills. It's an easier transition for them to make, and they still have a little bit of tillage in the system with the higher disturbance drills. And as they progress, some of them have progressed to the lower disturbance drills and ultimately into no-till. I don't really see a guy starting out with 100% no-till and going back to a high disturbance drill, though it happens at times for certain reasons on their operation. It's generally not a two-way street where we're seeing people move back and forth between direct seed and no-till all the time. I view it as a progression from direct seed into no-till type systems.
Isn't there a drawback in terms of the lack of tillage and pH, and that you're stratifying the soil in terms of the pH?
There's no doubt that you see stratification layers in some of the direct seed and no-till systems, and some of that's due to the lack of tillage that's going on. I think there's researchers out there that can provide you much better information on that probably than I can, but I think it's important to understand that over time, a stratified layer of pH in the top of a direct seed or no-till system, may get over the hurdle quicker than somebody that's stirring that problem up in the top 6 inches of the soil and continuing to add to the challenge. So over time, you're not removing the problem, you're just mixing the problem, with another 3 or 4 inches of soil. So these direct seed and no-till guys are trying to address some of that with different fertilizers that have less impact on acidity in the soil. They're using diverse crop rotations to really try to help manage those situations. And then some of the crops that are out there to help to try to address some of those stratification layers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Is there anything new coming with regard to drill technology?
Well, the one thing that I see and hear about right now is that I do think you're going to see a fairly rapid move by some of the drill manufacturers to go toward more of a seed singulation technology, similar to what we're seeing in corn and those kind of crops. And simply that's occurring because we're putting on such high value seed these days. There's a agronomic benefit that people are starting to see from singulation technology in our region, just for spacing the seed out a little bit better and getting the right rates on. But when you start looking at the high value seed that we're placing out there, and you can really hone in on the rate with those singulation type openers, I think you're going to see more of that coming. It's going to take time, but we're starting to see it already.
Although the Direct Seed Association has upwards of 300 members, there are many more farmers who farm with a direct seed drill who should be members. Today's PNDSA is a much more welcoming organization whose membership is eager to share their hard-won knowledge. A good place to test the PNDSA waters is by attending their annual Direct Seed Conference in the Tri-Cities. The 2020 event will be held January 7th and 8th at the Three Rivers Convention Center in Kennewick. Upwards of 500 register each year. Put it on your calendar, folks. January 7th and 8th. I hope you've enjoyed episode 139, or what I entitled, Direct Seeding, a System of Change. Please join me again next week for another episode of Weed All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation in times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.